Hey, big welcome to everybody joining us here in the Funhouse. Today's podcast is brought to you by my guy Brad Wiepa and Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation. Right now, Brad's in the process of helping one of my relocation clients close the deal on a brand spanking new dream home here in Minnesota. I love the fact that I get an update from him this morning. Closing's not for 2 months. He's already on it. He's already taking care of the things that need to be taken care of to get them into this home and make sure that they get a really, really good mortgage and a great loan. And that's what he does, man. He's diligent. He's smart. He's going to give you wise counsel. He's going to put you in the best possible product and you're going to feel really comfortable doing it. There's no mystery. There's no gray area. There's no BS. Great communication, great service. He's just really, really good at what he does. Click Brad's logo on the podcast homepage if you want to learn more and get connected. And just remember the podcast today being brought to you by Brad Wiepa and Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation.
The information in this podcast contains personal opinions and may not entirely represent those of Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation, NMLS number 2289. Fairway does not guarantee any services, information, and or advice provided by the individuals. This is not an offer to enter into an agreement. Not all customers will qualify. Information, rates, and programs are subject to change without notice. All products are subject to credit and property approval. Other restrictions and limitations may apply. Equal housing opportunity, Brad Wiepa, LO, NMLS number 539879, Arizona license number BK-0904162.
My guest today is probably more familiar to me than anyone I've had during the brief tenure of this podcast. I've known him for the better part of 54 years, I believe. And in that time, he has been a baseball player.
Blue chip athlete.
He has.
Most major colleges.
He has painted curbs for a living for about a day and a half. He worked as a grease monkey for a while in a tire shop, too, when we were growing up, flipping burgers at some point as a child. And at some point when he was transitioning from a youth to a college student, he realized he really didn't want to work that hard for a living in true Anderson male fashion and jumped into the world of stand-up comedy. From there, he has gone on to be a road comic, a television producer. He's owned his own production company. He's an outstanding father and husband. And he is also my one and only sibling, ladies and gentlemen, TV producer, KP Anderson.
Can you cut the father and husband part and replace it with daytime Emmy winner?
I forgot about that. And funny, that's the first thing you'd bring up. I Googled you today, and that's the first picture I saw was you with the daytime Emmy.
Really? Wow.
Right. Yeah. And you had like your own Google page. Like it popped up with all these different pictures of you, different sizes and like a bio and everything else. I thought, my God, that's impressive.
Oh Lord, we're going to have to get rid of that.
I Google myself and I get like newspaper headlines that say Joe Anderson fired.
You also neglected to mention that I got fired from a machine shop in Cambridge, Minnesota after driving through the wall. So,
well, thanks for coming on today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to be here, man. How's things? How's home?
Home is great. It's snowing again here. it's 40 degrees. Well, it was 40 degrees overnight. It's dropped down to 21 now. And home will be someplace warmer, I hope, next winter. That's my goal.
Nice.
Get out of Minnesota where I can at least not have to wear long underwear between September and March or April or whenever it is.
Yeah. I'm enjoying. As you may know, we moved to the East Coast last year and we have not gotten hit by anything bad. So I am loving life here in Connecticut.
Are you disappointed in that you haven't been hit by a big snowstorm or a nor'easter or something like that?
A little. It's like it snows. It snows and it melts right away. And that's great, but it kind of sucks until I talk to you or mom. And then I go, oh, you know what? This is exactly what it should be. I get the magic of the snow falling and then I don't have to deal with it in the morning.
It's gone, right? It melts. You just don't have to shovel, don't have to do anything.
Yeah, it's made for a rough ski season, and I'm irritated about that because that was one of the things I was very excited to move out here for. And I leased skis that I've gotten to use twice this winter.
And how do you lease skis?
Apparently they do that now. Oh, I worked in a ski shop and
came. Yeah, you did do that too. Yeah. God, you had a lot of jobs growing up.
Yeah, I moved through this world. They do that now apparently, where it's not like you go to Wild Mountain and you rent skis for the night, which I guess they still do. But I literally brought my old skis into a place in Armonk, New York, to get them cleaned up, and they looked at them and went, "You need new skis." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Well, what do I do about that?" And then they went, "Well, you lease them now." And I was like, "Okay, cool." So I leased them, and I paid like $240 for the skis to lease them for the winter, and another $120 for the boots. And I was like, "This is a deal. I don't have to buy new skis and boots." Except now I've used them twice, and they're not amortizing well at all.
So when do you have to bring them back? I mean, could you keep them through July and like go to Switzerland and ski with them if you wanted to?
No, apparently like mid-April is when I'm supposed to return them. But I'm told that the owner of the place is a good dude and kind of gives you the ability to buy them for much, much cheaper than you would have had you bought them new. So I'm sort of leaning on that. I'm going, now okay, you, well, cool. Yeah, eventually.
You mentioned Wild Mountain, mm-hmm. a staple of our youth growing up in mm-hmm. Cambridge, the two of us. And I want to give you the chance. Okay, so last week I ran into Paul Charchian and his wife, Roxy. Mm-hmm. And when I had Church on the podcast, he mentioned mm-hmm. an incident between you and Roxy back when you were probably about 11 years old. And she confirmed that it was a middle school incident. And she also confirmed that your intentions were pure. You were just trying to be nice. There was mm-hmm. nothing scandalous about it. Is there anything you want to add to that? Just because you listened to the podcast and texted me within about 8 seconds of hearing that part, concerned about why it was in the first 2 minutes of the show.
If memory serves, and like, look, all if I have to catalog all of my romantic failures, the title of the book will be called "If Memory Serves."
Yeah,
I believe. I'm just going to come clean. Like, I think what happened was, I think we were in like seventh grade. So that was I was in eighth, and Roxy was in seventh. She was a year younger than me. One thing that everybody got wrong, and Roxy, if you're listening, your husband aged you up. But if memory serves, I asked her to go to the movies with me at the Cambridge Movie Theater.
You worked there too.
And she said yes. And there were a whole bunch of people there because that was the back in the day when everybody just went to the movie theater on Friday night. And we were sitting together, and we were the talk of the theater, clearly. Like a power couple was being formed at that moment in time.
Was there like a murmur when you guys walked in the door? There was like a murmur that went through the crowd.
Yeah. And then at the urging of some friends who shall be named Max Hernberger, I believe that what I did was I tried to roll the car window down move. Like I tried to put my arm around her in the theater, and before I got the arm up to 12 o'clock. But before it got down to 11, she was up out of her seat and on her way home. And Roxy and I have been friends for a long time. We've actually spoken about this since. It's been a couple of years since we've gotten a chance to talk to each other. But back when I was doing stand up in Minneapolis, she came to one of the shows, and I believe we had a drinks and even though we remained friends, because she started dating our neighbor Mitch Reiners for a long time after that.
And
Mitch got to roll the car window down, I'll tell you that much. But I think we went out for drinks at Bullwinkle's again, if memory serves.
Oh my God.
And we cleared the air on that night, for once and for all. I think I was too young for my intentions to be anything other than, oh God, here we go.
That's what it's like now. We've both been married long enough. It's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Just and the response the is the same.
Oh God, here we go.
And they get up and walk away.
Yep.
So wait, we've run down so far the jobs you had. Mm-hmm. Grease Monkey, movie theater. Mm-hmm. Didn't you work at Cindy's flipping burgers at one point?
Is that what it was called? Yeah. No,
it was Cindy's.
It was Hardee's. I did Hardee's.
Oh, you did Hardee's. Okay.
Yeah.
What else? There's been a couple others that we met. You were a lifeguard too for a while, weren't you?
I was a lifeguard at the Cambridge pool. I worked at Cambridge Municipal Liquors. I worked at the movie theaters in Cambridge, and I worked at the Roseville 4 theaters, and I worked at the Harmar Mall theaters. I was a telemarketer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I did a lot.
Wait, did dad get you the telemarketer job?
I think he did. You know, the craziest thing is, like, I would like to think that of the people that were telemarketing subscriptions to the Minneapolis Star Tribune in that era, that I would be the one who kind of came out with like the most unique resume out of the deal. But you know who else was there at that time? Was Charlie Kaufman.
Wait, I don't know who Charlie Kaufman is.
Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind writer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he actually worked there as well, and he was there. I looked it up because I read it someplace, and then I had to see it. I was like, holy crap, Charlie Kaufman actually worked, was hawking subscriptions to getting the Saturday and Monday through Friday papers added to your Sunday subscription, bother you at dinner call team that I was on.
The only reason I ask is because the Star Tribune job he got me was going to the building at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night and stuffing Sunday newspapers full of advertising.
Yeah. Well, you were.
He got you the telemarketing job, the cushy chair, and I got to go hang out in the basement of the Star Tribune stuffing Sunday papers.
I was better with my words.
Oh, is that what it was? There might be some more layers to that. That's another podcast entirely.
So I was at Hamlin at that time. I was riding the bus back and forth from Minneapolis
to
St. Paul, and then stopping. I was like 19 years old or 20 years old, and stopping at what was that? Oh God, it was like Jukebox Friday Night or something like that.
Jukebox Saturday Night.
Jukebox Saturday Night, yeah, and drinking underage and playing pull off lotto tickets.
Oh my God,
with my earnings.
That's the one that was that's on University Avenue, or it used to be, right? Like University and Snelling.
Yeah, that's where the bus would let me off. And so
you would go in there.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you go to college and you've had all these jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you get this idea in your head that you're going to go to an open mic and do comedy.
Yeah.
That's and when I heard that, I mean, this is years and years, 30 some years ago, right? But when I heard that, I thought, where is this coming from? Because there was never any real inkling when we were growing up that was a direction that you wanted to go, or did I miss something?
Well, I mean, I was always a fan. Like, I was always, you know, Tonight Show, no matter who was on, you know, Richard Pryor, Don Rickles, Buddy Hackett, whoever was on the Tonight Show, I was always, you know, angling to stay up and watch. And I love Saturday Night Live, and I love Monty Python. And you know, the movie theater thing was a little bit of a hint that I really loved. I really loved the idea of making people laugh, and sort of, I guess what sort of pulled itself through ultimately was, more so than that, I loved the sort of intellectual math of comedy and jokes and dialogue and things like that. And so I would, you know, if a particularly great movie, or even if a really bad one that happened to be insanely funny, like A Christmas Vacation was at the Roseville Four Theaters when I was working there before I started doing stand-up, I would, as soon as I got done doing anything that remotely resembled work I had to do, I would run back in and watch the movies and watch the scenes and memorize the scenes and think about the beats and think about the timing and all the other stuff. And then I was a communications major at Hamlin, and I was in a public speaking class. And the professor in the class, I believe his name was Dave Lopaco, had kind of told me after one speech, he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing at this point in my life, but he said something along the lines of, you know, your speeches lack an incredible amount of research and fact checking. And any of the things that you're supposed to do when giving persuasive speeches, but they're really funny. And he said, and I don't know what to do with you because you're a very good speaker, but you don't do the work. You don't do the research. You don't do anything else. You just write really funny speeches about whatever, Andrew Jackson or whatever the hell else you're supposed to be talking about. And he was the one who said, he gave me a Twin Cities Reader and pointed at the Comedy Gallery in Uptown at the time, a Williams Pub location, and said, you know, they do an open mic here and you should go down and you should try it. And if you do and you report back, I'll pass you in the class. And so I did. And that first night, I happened to get lucky that first night, Scott Hansen, who ran the Comedy Galleries, rest him, and his brother Tom happened to be there, and they saw me. And they gave me a job being the house MC at a Days Inn in Maplewood location that they had. And that was kind of it. And that was kind of like, you know, everything all of a sudden, you know, the everything was pointed in a direction that seemed clear to me.
Was there like a moment when, because that's like Prodigy stuff, right? You do one set, open mic, and Scott Hansen's offering you a job as a host, right? I mean, that doesn't happen with a lot of people. Did it click with you right away and said, this is my direction, I'm not ever doing anything else again?
Yeah, pretty quickly. I mean, I wasn't my second night on stage, I was doing my first night emceeing at the Maplewood Club, and the headliner was a comic by the name of Sid Youngers, who is a great comic and a great writer, and wrote on, you know, Roseanne, and he worked with me on Norm Macdonald's show on Netflix, and he's had an amazing career. But he was a Minneapolis local who'd moved to LA, and he was back in town, and he was headlining that night. And we had talked a little bit before the show, and then I went up on stage and did my 5-10 minutes, whatever it was, and I walked off and sat down next to him at the bar, and he said, "How long you been doing it again?" And I said, "That was my second time." And he went, "Oh, I thought you just sucked." And so it wasn't, you know, there was a lot of learning to do, but I was a good salesman of the newspaper, and I did do some theater in college, and I was good at the performative talky stuff. And so, and I basically had this sort of like David Letterman-esque way about me that was very much built from, you know, I sort of built a personality by watching Letterman for all those years. Mm-hmm. And I sort of defaulted into that. And so I was able to sort of, where other people get a lot of first time jitters trying to find their way, I was sort of able to maybe default and absorb into a voice that made it easier for me. And I mean, honestly, Scott and Tom were probably just like, yeah, that idiot looks like it'll work for $25 a weekend. And that was as much thought as they put into it at the time. Besides, he gets the words out, and, you know,
yeah.
I sort of looked like a promising up and coming comic. I had that kind of, I think what we used to call it joking around was we'd call it the cover of Middle Act magazine look with the, you know, the sport coat and the t-shirt and the tennis shoes and the jeans and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of hit the comedy scene here in the Twin Cities at the right time too. I mean, it was back then at the beginning of, I think probably, I guess what has to be the richest time in history in comedy here, right? Scott was around. Louis Anderson was mm-hmm. still around a little bit, in and out of town. I mean, there were all sorts of really, really funny and talented people, not only that were already in the industry, but people that came in with you as well. And I have to imagine that the creative culture helped everybody to elevate their games as they moved through this process and this time in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, my class, the group that I kind of came up with, and the notable names from that group who've gone on to, like, Maria Bamford and I started doing stand up on the same night, that same night. Jackie Cation came out of that batch. Mitch Hedberg came out of that batch, except Mitch went down to Florida to get his actual start, but then started working out in Minnesota quite a bit. And Nick Swartzen wasn't too far behind us. But I think that what really worked well for us was that with Scott and Louie and Bill Bauer and Alex Cole and Sid and all those people, they were really the vanguard. They were really the ones who made Minneapolis kind of a comedy destination. And there were a lot of great comics that that became writers on shows that came out of that scene. And right at the same time that I was coming in, a lot of them were leaving. I should mention Josh Weinstein. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were leaving, and like Mystery Science Theater was sort of a hit cult show coming out of Minneapolis at the time, and they were just moving towards Comedy Central. So Joel Hodgson and that group. So there was a lot of bandwidth made by their success for new people to step in and get successful. And there was a lot of sort of like roadmap of how you go about it that had been laid down by that group ahead of us.
Yeah. And so you were able to kind of fill in, right? They start heading out of town, going off to greener pastures and trying to make it big out in LA. And then your whole crew can kind of come in and take that spot and get mm-hmm. that spotlight. And again, that's just part of the development, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that really is it. And there's so many good, I mean, as you know, John DeBoer and Michael Thorne and John Bush and Colleen Cruz and Ken Bradley, there was the, like, we were Fancy Ray McCloney was in our group.
Wow.
We were sort of like it almost felt like, I don't know, like a, like if and when the Kansas City Chiefs reload, you know, sort of feeling just like a whole lot of greatness just left. And here's this group of people who've been watching, and we just all got to kind of shoot onto the scene. And, you know, between Scott and Lewis Lee, who runs Acme Comedy Company still up there, they were really, really, really giving us so much stage time and so much work. And there were so many one night gigs to be done. I mean, by my senior year at Hamlin, I would basically go to class Monday, Tuesday, and then I'd be on the road Wednesday through Sunday, and get back. And whenever I was in town, in order to get my internship, in order to graduate done, Scott would let me work in the offices at the Comedy Gallery. So it all kind of came together incredibly nicely. And at the same time, Scott had opened up this big Death Star of a club in Galtier Plaza in St. Paul, mm-hmm. that he made me, when it first opened, he made me a regular house MC in there, and then started giving me the middle act work and eventually the headline work in there. And with that club, because it was so big, he started bringing in really big name headliners. So it's kind of like, if you look at especially the early years of my resume, my Hollywood resume, or whatever you want to call it, my TV resume, like that's very much fed by that. Like, I got to work with Bill Maher in that room. I got to work with Larry Miller in that room. I got to work with Ellen and Roseanne and Tom and all the, and so many people that came through that room. I was their young, guy that they thought had some chops, and Jesus, David Spade and I were together, but that was actually at the Minneapolis club. Like, I got a lot of opportunity to get seen. And then that opportunity turned into ultimately the writing jobs and the producing jobs that kind of defined the first maybe 5 or 6 years of me being in LA.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there competition amongst you and the rest of your class? It always struck me as if you all got along very well and were maybe more supportive of each other than anything else. But I would also assume that there had to be some competition for stage time and for dollars and for bookings and opportunities like that. Was that present, and was that something difficult to navigate?
You know, I think that's another interesting thing. I think that, like, and Scott took on a lot of this, is like, Scott took on sort of in our era, maybe now that I've got, you know, years behind me, and God knows I was guilty of being as, you know, as touchy about things as anybody else. But Scott took on kind of like a bad guy and absorbed it so that all of us. So if Scott said, you got to work clean these shows because, you know, these types of crowds are showing up, we all blamed him, all got mad at him. If Scott gave someone else a gig that one of us wanted, we got to blame Scott instead of the other person. You know, he sort of owned it stoically. And I think a whole bunch of us, when we get opportunities to speak, we all feel kind of baddish about that now, because we realize that, you know, we were getting an opportunity to start our careers, and somebody had to be the person who went, you know, you're going here, you're going here, you're going here. The good side of all of it was that, and so we sort of unified in that way. And especially like when Knuckleheads opened out at the Mall of America, or when Lewis got Acme going and we all started breaking away and doing those other clubs, we sort of like organized our own rebellion and forced Scott to not be able to demand that we just stay at his clubs. And I think hindsight being 2020, I think if we would have just talked to him, he probably would have been okay with it anyways.
Yeah.
But I think that also, you know, I think that the other side of that is that there was so much work to be had at that point in time. And like, literally, like I had the Cambridge American Legion Hall that I was booking until I handed it over to Scott and Tom to book. And that was once a month. And there was the club in Maplewood, and there were clubs out, you know, heading out towards Minnetonka, and there were clubs, and there were all kinds of places, northern, southern Minnesota. You could play Grandma's in Duluth, and then you could be down in Rochester, and then you could be in Grand Forks, and then Minot, and up in Winnipeg. And there was so much work to be had that those of us who had kind of made it past that open mic litmus and built 30 minutes or more of an act had a job to go do. And so we were constantly, you know, a lot of the times what we'd wind up doing is going, you know, I'd be off in Thief River Falls doing a set and DeBoer would be down in Rochester, and Ken and Colleen would be up in Duluth. And if we all got done early enough and we'd haul ass back to Minneapolis so that we could all meet up at an Embers and sit and talk about our gigs and laugh and joke. And, you know, on the nights that one of us was working in Minneapolis and somebody wasn't working, we always gave each other stage time. And we're kind of, you know, not, it wasn't like it was always, you know, we're comics and we're kind of crazy. And there's, you know, God knows, I think if you talk to anybody about me in that period of time, you wouldn't be too many sentences away from hearing the word ego somewhere in the, in the conversation. You know, like, I think that we were all, you know, we were all young. We were all very, you know, some of us more full of ourselves than others, but we all also had just a ton of drama in us and a ton of ability to F up our own lives at any turn. And so, you know, so yeah, there were fights and there was other stuff, but I think that it's also like one thing you find out when you start doing stuff in show business for a living is that you sort of grow this new family that you're really, you know, at a certain stage early on, you're really the only ones who even remotely understand each other and why the hell you're doing it.
Yeah. I was thinking about today, like the early days when you were on the road and I had that house on 44th uh-huh. Avenue and you lived with me, and John DeBoer emerged from the basement every once in a while to go, he would go do his sets as well. He was living mm-hmm. and I joke, John's a wonderful guy. And you guys were both there. And I remember you guys would come home and you would sit outside my bedroom window and you would tell mm-hmm. jokes in the middle uh-huh. of the night. And you uh-huh. would smoke cigarettes uh-huh. and your future sister-in-law would get so angry with you guys uh-huh. and she would wake up in the morning and she would vacuum in the home around your rooms and above John's room. Uh-huh. And, you know, there was a certain level of self-absorption back then where you didn't think there was anything wrong with coming home at 2 a.m. and having a cigarette outside my bedroom window yeah. and telling jokes. But I also think that in order to be successful, you need to have some of that within you, right? You can't go be successful at something without really caring probably more about your destination or your process mm-hmm. than the world around you. You got to have a little bit of a bubble around you where you're not even recognizing what's going on outside of it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's such a regrettable single-minded focus that, you know, it takes to some degree or another. I think that a little bit more maturity would have resolved some of that. But like I very much, you know, the fact that my sister-in-law I think genuinely likes me now.
Yeah, she does.
Or at least she likes my wife enough to not hit me anymore.
She didn't like you waking her up. And I can tell you from 30 years of experience, that's number one on the no-no list.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really like there's a whole bunch when you look back on an era like that. And I think everybody's different. Like I was particularly obnoxious in that regard. I don't think every comic who, you know, I don't think every comic who ever succeeded was partying until, you know, until 3 o'clock in the morning and sitting outside of windows with people sleeping and smoking and laughing and yelling and stuff. But I think that there was, you know, there was something about that moment that you just kind of go like all of this. It's such a rush. It's such a constant rush. Of all of this is fueling this level of creativity and this level of like what ultimately becomes this killer feedback machine for anybody who's self-involved or just loves attention is you're standing on that stage and you're taking whatever you can remember from that, you know, from that late night sitting in the yeah. backyard or that whatever that breakfast at 1 o'clock in the morning where you smoked some pot at 10 and then wandered out of the house finally. And all of that stuff just fuels this kind of like you're never not on the job, but the job is the greatest job ever. And there's, you know, you get up on stage, but then there's also a wake behind you that I think that everybody who wants to be kind of healthy about their lives eventually has to acknowledge the wake, has to accept it. And yeah. you know, that's a whole other podcast I would imagine, but
now we've got two other podcasts to do.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a thing that, and it also, I think that, you know, jumping the narrative forward a little bit into the writing and the producing and the stuff that I've been doing for the last 20 years that stands out more than the stand-up, even though I still do some stand-up, is that ejecting, if you want to be the person who's in charge of shows and you want to be the person who's in charge of productions and you want to be, you know, a head writer or creative lead on something, ultimately that's all of the stuff that has to get flushed. Like, you can't be any of those things anymore. Yeah. I think that there's a whole bunch of people who've worked with a whole bunch of different showrunners who would go, eh, I don't know. like, we've stayed a lot of late nights because someone just wanted to sit and tell stories, you know, and stuff like that. There's still a bit of a Napoleon complex. We'll say that.
Excuse me. Sorry. No, but that's all right.
Yeah. But I think that, like, there's the writing in a room. Like, that was my first step out of that world, or first step into a world, you know, loosely connected to it, and working for Keenan Ivory Wayans and for Bill Maher. And all of a sudden you're in a room with a whole bunch of people who are the writers, and they're living their dream in that room. This is exactly what they wanted to be doing. And you can't come in with all of the arrogance of, well, everything I say that comes out of my mouth is funny to my friends. You know, there's real competition, and there's, you know, and if you don't do this, if you don't meet the standard that they're looking for in 10 weeks, we're going to tell you, you don't get to do it anymore. And by the way, this is the biggest check you've ever gotten.
Yeah.
And so getting rid of all that self-centeredness, at least in how you interact professionally with people, becomes really important really fast. And I think that a lot of comics struggle making that move in there. I just sort of luckily got handed my ass in so many different ways across life and in so many different, you know, in so many different professional environments. Like, I remember going into, I think it was Spaghetti Works in Des Moines, Iowa, in the middle of the day and before my show, and finding the manager and telling them how I'd like the lighting to be and where I want the, you know, and wanting to do a sound check in the middle of their lunch rush and stuff like that. And just having the guy just look at me and go, you are not who you think you are.
Right.
And I went, what?
Yeah.
Went, go back to the hotel that I'm paying for and come back at 6:45. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So you make the decision to head out to Los Angeles. And to me, so at that point, because you're kind of at a fork in the road, I mean, maybe you're not personally at that point, but I think people in your profession, they find that fork in the road and where you say, okay, do I want to continue down the path where I'm on stage, I'm under the bright lights, I want to be a face on a screen, mm-hmm. or do I make this decision where I want to go behind the scenes and maybe there's a little more stability, there's more money right now, you know, mm-hmm. the pie is a little bit bigger for everybody. Was that part of the motivation to move to Los Angeles, which everybody, if you're going to be in show business, has to sooner or later move to Los Angeles, right? So you make that decision. But what was the plan when you went out there?
Yeah, LA or New York, I think. For me, I went out there still with the, I like being the guy on the stage, I want to be the guy in front of the camera mentality. But over those years, I had been working with a lot of name headline comics who kept talking about my writing and kept talking about, you know, the way that you write, you kind of unlayer things and you go deeper than comics usually do. And and you're really fast on your feet and you keep, you know, I get off stage and you tell me a line that I could use and I use it the next night and it works. And that, have you thought about, you know, there's a lot of like, you should think about the writing thing. You should think about the writing thing. And Bill Maher was, you know, one of those people, and Bill was a big supporter of me as a comic slash guy who knew how to find weed guy. And
everybody's got to have that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we were, you know, and so he was absolutely very much at the leading or at the beginning end of that. But there were other people. You know, Ellen was very nice to me. Which isn't something I hear a lot of people say these days.
Yeah, you might be the last person.
Yeah, I'm also probably the last guy who hit on her. But I, you know, again,
that drove her out into the open. I can't take this anymore. I can't take it anymore. Exactly. I got to let the world know.
if memory serves, the K.P. Anderson failure at Love Chronicles. But there were a lot of people that kind of came along and were in that. But Bill actually, you know, made me the an alternating warm up person on the show, and he gave me a writing job on the show. And he gave me a lot of opportunity, and he hired me and fired me twice. And so there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot that I got out of that experience. And a lot of what I learned about how I now run TV programs still comes from observing Bill and the team, the head writer and the producer, Scott Carter and Chris Kelly, who were in charge of those departments, you know, back then. So it was all super helpful, but it was at that when I left LA or left Minneapolis for LA, it was very much, I had been, you know, I was always very impatient, and I had made it to sort of like the headliner status in Minneapolis and in all the road clubs around there. And there wasn't much more for me to do except for see if I could take it to another level. You know, also the North Stars had just gotten traded to Dallas for Herschel Walker. And I was like, well, Gretzky's in LA, I guess I'll go there.
Yeah, right. You may as well follow the puck if you have to, I guess.
Exactly. Now I'm an Islanders fan.
You're like that though. Like you're so like you were a Dodger fan because you were in LA, and you were a Rams fan. I mean, that's not right.
No, I was a Chargers fan.
You're a Chargers fan.
Yeah, I can't move. I have to stay in a division, or I can't be an American League fan of any other team besides the Twins.
Okay.
So I had the Dodgers. I can't be an NFC. I can't like go, oh, I'm going to just start watching the Giants for the heck of it. God help me. I have to stick with the Vikings.
Yeah.
I was a Chargers. I still kind of like I really like Justin Herbert. We moved last fall out east, and I kind of just went, well, I'm not staying up till 10 o'clock to watch the start of the Dodger game. So I started watching the Mets because I can't watch the Yankees, or I can't cheer for the Yankees.
And I think you were gone by the time the Wild came in. And so you get a pass on the NHL. You can be like an NHL free agent for the rest of your life if you want.
Exactly. Plus two things. Vitally important. Jonathan Quick was the greatest goalie in the history of the Los Angeles Kings.
Yep.
And better than Rob Stauber. And he deserved better than what he got a couple weeks ago.
He was not a happy camper.
Yes. So I've been able to sort of put Jonathan Quick, or put the Kings rather, in another box. Because of you, I've always kind of had this, like, because you really loved Mike Bossy and you really loved the Islanders jersey.
I was a huge Islanders guy growing up.
Yeah. So I went, great. They're right across Long Island Sound from me. It's an easy drive. I'm an Isles fan.
There you go. That's an easy. Yeah. It's easier than going. Well, I mean, it's not hard to go into the city and go to a Rangers game either.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to.
Yeah. But, you know, that feels like the easy road.
Yeah, I guess so. No, that's okay. So you start off with Bill Maher. You go to Keenan Ivory weigh-ins.
Mm-hmm.
Then the soup.
Mm-hmm.
And the soup is where, what else? What did I miss?
Let's see. I started at Keenan, actually.
Okay.
And then I went Politically Incorrect. And then my first joke on air was the night the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke.
Nice.
So that, if you want to place a date on that. And then I did 9 months on there, and then Bill politely called me into his office and said, so I got my contract picked up twice. And then on that third one, he called me in and he said, you know, a lot of people leave here in body bags. That's not happening for you, but I feel like you need to mature more as a writer. And so I'm going to come find you in 3 to 6 months. We're going to give you another run. We're going to swap you out. And I went, oh, okay.
Oh,
and so I went back. Yeah, I went back on the road and did some stand up. And then 4 months later, Bill found me at the Improv and said, hey, you want to come back? And I went back for another 9 months. and towards the end of that run, it was, I don't want to put this in a way that isn't accurate to exactly what happened. So let's call it what it is. I got fired again. But at that same point in time, and I think that it sort of played into it, because I kind of started out with a bang, and I was getting a lot of jokes on the show, and I was getting a lot of stuff going, and they were very happy with me. But I think that sort of intellectually, I started to realize that there was something about being a staff writer on a show like that, especially a show that was really, you know, was embedded in the culture, and it was, and the writers who were succeeding and working on that show weren't going anywhere. And that means that there wasn't a lot of upward mobility in that space. And I think that I started to sort of fall asleep at the wheel a little bit. And so the next time Bill called me into the office, I was kind of aware of what was going on, and I wasn't that upset about it. I was going to miss the money, I knew, but Bill, to his credit, said, you know, it doesn't feel like you and I are on the same page creatively right now. And he said, it's different than what it was the last time. You're doing the workload the way that the workload is prescribed, and your jokes are good, but they're not jokes for me. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I hear you. And so he did. He actually got me a job. We talked a lot about what I wanted to do. And I said, you know, I still want to write, but I'm fascinated by the process of how these shows get made. And when you're writing on them, a lot of the time, especially on a show like this, your whole job, you know, 10 till 6 every day is fill that pipeline with words for Bill. And you don't get a lot of time to think about or invest yourself in how the rest of it gets made. And so Bill got me a job with a company that did the promos for Politically Incorrect, the on-air promos. And he was like, here, I'll talk to my friend Shep, and Shep will kind of take you under his wing. And Shep let me go be on the set for Politically Incorrect and for other shows and be a part of this little small tiny piece of production, just queuing up the promos and having the host read them. But I got to do it on this show called The X Show on FX.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, where Mark Cronin, who was the executive producer, and Gary Auerbach took a liking to me, and they needed a writer to write jokes, but they also were constantly, it was 5 nights a week, and it was a crazy production, and they needed young producers, so they gave me a job as a producer on that show, as well as like the only writer on that show. So I got to write all the jokes for all 5 episodes a week, but I got to produce myself 1 episode a week as well. And then that led to the first head writer job, which was More Sports on ESPN with Jay Moore, which led to head writer on the Wayne Brady Show. And then I went over to Last Comic Standing with Jay for a couple of seasons on NBC. And I was supervising producer and writer on that. And that's when Ted Harbert, who ran E! At the time, he and I had known each other from a pilot script for Jessica Simpson that he was producing, that they hired me to punch up. And Ted called me and asked me if I wanted to take a look at The Soup, which they had just started, and Joel was just starting out as the host. And he said, you know, I'm probably going to cancel it in 10 weeks, but if I don't, if you do a good job, and if you keep Joel out of my office because he comes in and yells at me all the time, I'll give you your next job. And so I went, okay. And I went and I sat down and I met with Joel and we got along. And then, you know, 12 years later, my kid was in private school.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad because I glossed over like so much. I went, oh, well, you went right from Bill Maher. Right to The Soup, right? You're like, nah, no, there was about 15 years of shit in there I did.
Yeah, but you know, like, look, you had stuff going on too. Plus, I think everybody in Minneapolis was just enjoying the silence.
Well, and then as soon as you said The X Show, I flashed on your wedding reception and everything on in the backyard around the pool for the wedding reception. That might have been, was Bert Kreischer on The X Show?
Yeah, Bert was one of the hosts.
That might have been the first time I saw Bert with his shirt off.
Yeah, Bert was there with his shirt off. Doug Stanhope was there with all of his clothes off.
All of his clothes off, swimming in the pool.
I don't think Ken Jeong didn't get naked that night, did he? No, he didn't.
No.
Yeah, no. Ken was waiting to get naked until the big bucks were showing up.
That was, oh my gosh, I'd completely forgotten about that. Yeah. That just goes, well, I can tell people, like, before we got on the air, there was this, Brandon, the producer, had to deal with the two of us for like 10 minutes on technical issues, talking at the same time, losing our microphones, losing our headphones. It just kind of goes to show you how things have degraded mentally for me, where I completely forgot like 15 years of your life.
That's okay.
I feel bad about that.
I have mostly too.
We'll get back to the podcast in a moment, but first let's quickly talk about home buying and home selling. Another round of wintry weather has moved through, but the market's starting to pick up. We're getting some steam. Buyers are shopping right now. They're out there, a bunch of them. They're making offers on properly priced homes, and those homes are moving quickly with multiple offers. What we're also seeing is that some homes are overpriced, and when you do that, they linger on the market. That's why it's really, really important on either side of the transaction to have a smart real estate agent working with you, help you to properly price that home you're going to sell so you can maximize your return on it, and also help you to make the right offer to purchase the home so you don't overspend and don't blow past the value of the house. That sets you up for failure down the road. If you have questions about the market and where it's going, let's get connected. I'm a licensed real estate agent in Minnesota. I have been helping clients get great value in and out of their homes for more than 10 years. Call me today at 651-251-4898 or email me at joe@rydellsd.com or click the link on the podcast page. Joe Anderson, licensed with REMAX Results in the state of Minnesota. Now, let's get back to the show. So the soup is where you kind of make it, you become sort of a go-to guy, right, in the industry where people, you're starting to see your name in headlines. I mean, it's a show that was really successful. I think it was also The Soup to me was kind of this gateway from conventional television and broadcasting and sitcoms into what TV has become now, with E! Becoming, you know, a channel that was in every house. And now you've got Netflix and Hulu and everybody else producing shows all around the clock. And the Soup to me kind of was part of that transition into the way television is now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was all part and parcel of this sort of, there's a whole other business part of it that, that's almost, it's sort of the way that the television business has changed in the 25, 30 some years that I've been working at some level or another of it is really dramatic and really dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just the streaming part, but the streaming part plays a big piece in sort of the economics of it and what budgets are and what kind of shows. And so it seems like by and large right now, there's basically two lanes. There's what they would call the big swing programming, which is, The Last of Us, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, all of the big premier programming. And then in that alternative unscripted space, it's all of the Voices and American Idols and big and Amazing Races and shows that are just like crazy huge visions and really, really broad and really expensive to make. And then there's what all of the rest of us do, which whether it's you know, Keeping Up with the Kardashians or Vanderpump Rules and in that docu-follow lane, to the kind of stuff that by and large I've been doing, which I would categorize as comedy variety that has an alternative bent, or talk comedy variety or stuff like that, that they basically see how much they can milk a small budget for in terms of revenue and in terms of playability. So our lane is louder and noisier with fewer resources. And when you talk about comedy, like everything that I do, by virtue of what they would hire me to do, but also by virtue of what I want to do, has comedy at the core of it. Because I feel like I don't have a lot of interest. Like, we did The Soup, and The Soup covered, you know, the height of reality television and the height of like the big sloppy, whether it's Being Bobby Brown what are some that you'd think I'd be able to remember the shows that we joked about for 12 years, or the Kardashians.
Andrew Zimmern. You took Andrew Zimmern to task a few times.
Yeah. But if you recall, in that era, it was, you know, basic cable was really driving a lot of what people watched. People had this, you know, the reason that Ted wanted to do The Soup, our predecessor was Talk Soup. That was, you know, Greg Kinnear and Aisha Tyler and John Henson and Hal Sparks. But then the Joel years, the 12 years of Joel, we were The Soup. And Ted very wisely was like, he wanted to launch reality programming on E! And in his mind, he thought that the best way to go about doing that was to get this show that talked about what was happening on all of the popular reality shows on all of the other networks. And so ultimately, we were getting people who were big fans of American Idol and big fans of whatever, Survivor and all that stuff, to come to E! to get this sort of comedic catch up on the big moments of the shows that they love. And then what Ted was able to do with that, or what he was able to do with that, I should say, was launch Dr. 90210 and launch Keeping Up with the Kardashians and launch all these other shows that became sort of like the bedrock ratings drivers of that era for them. So we served a really big business purpose for them, even though we were really sort of like we prided ourselves on being small and stupid and kind of like Conan O'Brien is Joel's biggest comedic influence. And, you know, Letterman is my biggest comedic influence, I think. And since we were the two, you know, primary comedic voices kind of merging to make what that was, it was, you know, it was silly. And our take on everything that we were showing, we knew that if we started to say, we had a long conversation about it, where if we started to say, show, like talk about a show and say, this sucks, then the audience who loved that show so much and was coming to get our take on it would go, well, then why am I watching you talk about it if you hate it? Yeah. So instead it was always, holy shit, you got to see this. And so we'd always enter the conversation with, regardless of what we personally thought about the show, we would just get attached to the moment and what silliness we could make of the moment instead.
And it was kind of like, I mean, television, while you've been in it, it is kind of an adapt or die industry, right? I mean, you kind of have, like you, and you have, right? I mean, you have seen this transition to where, you know, the whole industry has changed dramatically and you sort of have to pick your side and decide what you want to be in. And I think you were really fortunate to get that 12 years because, like you said, it bought you a nice house to put your kid through private school and, you know, it kind of sets you up where you can make some decisions now about what you want to do. And not a lot of people get a chance to run a show for that long.
Yeah, no. And everything that I've done since then has been for a much shorter period of time. Like even when we redid The Soup at Netflix, when we rebooted it as The Joel McHale Show at Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
We did I think 750 some odd episodes of The Soup, and we did 19 episodes of The Joel McHale Show.
And that was it.
And Joel and I remember I was up in Walker when we got the call that we were not doing more. And Joel called and he was like, well, what do you think? And I was like, like somewhere between 19 and 750 was the magic number.
Right. Yeah. Opposite ends of the spectrum there. You know, which show of yours is my all time favorite, don't you?
Actually, no. Which one?
Norm MacDonald.
Yeah. Yeah.
I loved it. I mean, I loved all the shows, but Norm was the kind of guy that, like, you know, for an old middle-aged dummy like me, I just thought it was, and it was so funny because you could see it going off the rails and then I could picture you on the other side of the camera witnessing it going off the rails and trying to get it steered back onto it as best you could.
You know, honestly, because it was Norma, this I'm going to take credit for is I very seldom attempted a steer back because that was Norm. You know, that was what he did. And usually the best was yet to come when he would take it off in a different direction. Also, like I very openly say this, I love that show too. I very openly will tell everyone of all of the shows that I've worked on, including the ones that I was just a writer on. I think that in a lot of ways, I had the least to do creatively with that show of everything that I've worked on. And that was entirely because Norm was going to be Norm no matter what. And the smart play, I would still argue, was to go, I can't be better at being Norm than Norm is. You know, and just and so just like sit back. Like I remember there was a great conversation he and I had after we had Lorne Michaels on the show. And we were sitting, there was a big conference room upstairs from the studio. And Norma, I came up and Norma goes, oh, what'd you think there, KP? How'd you like that one? And I said, well, I gotta be honest with you. I feel like, you know, we kind of left a couple of things on the table there, Norm. And he said, really, what do you think we left on the table? And I said, well, you know, it occurs to me that, you got fired by Lorne once. And he goes, yeah, I remember that. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, you spent an hour talking to him about the first season of Saturday Night Live, you know, the one that all the books have been written about. And then you talk to him about the movie The Three Amigos, which I love as much as you do, Norm, but I feel like the audience might have had some questions and thought there might be some answers given about when you got fired from Saturday Night Live. And he goes, yeah, but I know why he fired me. Why would that be interesting for me to ask him about?
It was unbelievable.
Like, hey. I was like, fair point. And I said, but then there's this other thing. I said that, you know, we're living in this time where it's very interesting to me that all of the people that Lorne Michaels was representing when he launched Saturday Night Live and when he, you know, and when it became this cultural movement of a show, that was a free speech type of movement. And, you know, all of the children and grandchildren of those people are now the people who are writing hashtags offended by what Saturday Night Live does. And I think that that's an interesting comparison and contrast. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I wish I should have brought that up. Why didn't you tell me to? And I was like, I did. I did every day since we booked Lorne Michaels on this show. But that was just Norm. He was going to do that show was to me. I mean, I loved everything that he did. I loved his sports show that he did on Comedy Central. I loved him on Weekend Update, and I loved him as a stand up. And I feel like that show was. I'm glad that we got to do that show. But I hesitate to take too much creative credit for it because it was always going to be just him.
It was so much fun. So I got to let you go because I got to go shovel and then I got to meet a guy for a beer. Advice you would give to the kids starting off today, because the industry has changed so mm-hmm. much since you got into it. The world has changed with social media and laptops mm-hmm. and cameras everywhere and YouTube and everything else. What would you tell the kids that were getting into the industry now that you would make, or maybe something you wish you knew back when? I mean, the advice I would give is don't let your brother, the comic, live in your house for 3 years because you won't get any sleep. But I mean, if you have advice that you would share, what would it be?
I think the piece of advice that I would share is that if you want to be in this industry, if you want to be on the creative side of this industry, that the good news is you have the devices around you and they're far more cost efficient than they used to be to constantly be making and constantly be creating and constantly be doing. And that's incumbent on you. If you want to be a writer, you got to write every day. If you want to make film, you've got to find something to make, and you've got to learn how to tell stories in a visual medium. You've got access to the ability to do that at all times. But the other thing that I would say is that if you want to do it professionally, you know, people give a lot of advice about the internet as a, you know, to young people, what you put of yourself out there. And they usually tend to think of it in terms of, you know, passionate feelings or nude pictures or whatever the hell else. But I think when you're making these, you can make something and learn from it without sending it out to the world. Like, make it and use it to educate yourself and watch it back and get great at it. And then once you feel like you've got traction and once you feel like you're telling good stories and you feel like you can stand behind what it is you're making because you feel like it's coming from a base of knowledge of how you go ahead and do it, that's when you start sharing it with the world. I think that a lot of times in my position, because we get a lot of, hey, will you look at this person who's a really hot TikToker? And will you look at this person who's a really, and I see the stuff and I just go, you know, I see a glimmer of a spark of something, but they're so not ready for this investment of, you know, tens of thousands to millions of dollars that people put into it at that level. But it's like, if I remember it when someone brings you up the next time, there's already going to be, and it's not really a me thing so much as it's an industry thing, is if people are going to remember you, have them remember you because what you did was great and inventive and new and fresh, and not because you just kept sending them shit.
Yeah. I'm Googling making money with nude pictures right now.
I don't think you can.
Might have to pay somebody to take them.
I mean, I'm not saying that there's not someone out there into it. I'm just saying that person is likely broke.
Joe will give you 45 cents to click on this link.
Yeah, there you go. Somehow you for a loss.
Thank you for doing this.
Hey, it was a blast. Good luck with everything, and I'll talk to you later tonight.
All right, sounds good.
All right. Thanks, bud.
Hey, thank you, everybody, for joining us here today in the Funhouse. That was really, really fun. You don't get to have that kind of professional conversation, or at least borderline professional conversation, with a sibling every day. I am very proud of my brother for his success. He's earned every bit of it. He's well-respected in the industry, and honestly, some of the messages he sent, if you're thinking about getting into show business, make sure you were taking notes, because he's telling you some stuff that really, really matters. Thank you for joining us here in the Funhouse today. If you can, subscribe. We'd love to have you do it on whatever platform fits your needs, and we're going to be back. We'll have more conversations, more cool guests, and more fun right here in the Funhouse on the Talk North Podcast Network. Be good.